University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents Nebraska State Attorney General Robert Speier, the 1987 Griswold Lecturer in Political Science. Speier was appointed Attorney General in March 1985 and elected to a four-year term in November 1986. A graduate of Harvard College and Harvard Law School, Speier was a former partner in an Omaha law firm and an adjunct associate professor of medical jurisprudence at the University of Nebraska College of Medicine from 1968 to 1984. He has served as president of the Omaha Bar Association, the Nebraska State Bar Association, Nebraska Continuing Legal Education Incorporated, and the Board of Directors of the Legal Aid Society of Omaha.
Good morning, and welcome once again to the Nebraska University Forum. One of the highlights of this series of presentations for me is always the annual Dwight P. Griswold Lecture in Political Science. The purpose of the lectureship is to illuminate the meaning of public service in today's world. Our speaker this morning is well qualified to address himself to that general subject. It is a real pleasure to have him with us this morning. In many ways, I feel that I am welcoming an old friend. Since I met the Attorney General briefly, 2 weeks ago? He's a graduate of Harvard College and Harvard Law School, and he is presently Attorney General of the state of Nebraska, appointed to that position by former Governor Robert Kerry, and elected to the office in his own right last November. He is a person of many talents. Had we provided a piano, he would have entertained us as we wandered into the auditorium. The title of his talk this morning is The Social Responsibilities of Public Service. Please welcome Nebraska Attorney General Robert Speier.
Thank you very much, Professor, and dear friends all. I certainly appreciate that kind introduction. I think I should tell you, however, that in this position of State Attorney General, one does not have any difficulty at all keeping humble. I'll give you two quick examples, but shortly after Governor Kerry appointed me Attorney General originally 2 years ago, One evening, the governor was to speak at a banquet, and he was taken ill with a 24-hour flu late one afternoon and simply was unable to speak. And so out of sheer desperation, why, his staff scoured me out of the south end of the Capitol building and said, "Will you go and speak for the governor tonight at this banquet?" And so I did do that. But I sensed during the dinner, before I had spoken, that the word had not gotten around to the people at the banquet that there was indeed a pinch hitter for the governor that was going to speak, because there was a woman that was looking up very quizzically at the head table sitting out in front and kind of staring at me. I could sense it. And then suddenly she said in one of these stage whispers that just wafted out over the entire room, she said, "My, my, the governor has aged since he took office." I would tell you one other humbling experience that comes to my mind and helps keep me and my staff not taking ourselves too seriously, although we certainly take the job seriously. When I became Attorney General, I, of course, completely separated myself from any private practice of law. But I also decided that I should disconnect myself from any business affiliations of any kind I had, just to avoid either any possible conflict of interest or indeed to avoid any conflict with regard to my time. I wanted to be sure that I could spend all of my time on state matters and not on any private business matters. Well, this was easy for me to do because I had only one private business activity other than my law practice, which I'd gotten out of, and that was that I was a member of a medium-sized publicly held corporate board, the Ball Corporation in Muncie, Indiana. Possibly if any of you do home canning, you may have heard of the Ball Jars, that company. Well, I was on that board, and I resigned from that board 2 weeks before becoming Attorney General. One of the requirements of federal law with regard to publicly held corporations, and this is also a requirement of the New York Stock Exchange where Ball stock is listed, is that whenever there is a change in directorship, this must immediately be announced publicly through the news wires on the financial press. And the reason for that is the theory that investors should know who is going on or going off of a corporate board, because the investors then will have knowledge as to who's running the corporation, and that will give them more information as to the value of their investments. The theory being, it's the so-called full disclosure theory under public securities law, that an investor should know who is leading these corporations in order to make intelligent decisions on the value of the stock. Well, I went over to Muncie, Indiana to my last board meeting, and I'll never forget it, on the 19th of February, and at 10 o'clock that morning submitted my resignation effective immediately. And Ball, of course, following the law, put it out on the financial news wires at 1 o'clock that afternoon that I had resigned from the board effective immediately. The next day on the New York Stock Exchange, Ball stock shot up 2.25 points. And that was the largest single increase in Ball stock price in any one trading day since Ball stock originally had gone on the New York Stock Exchange in 1971. So these things keep you humble. And I suggest to you that that's really basic to my theme today. Because what I want to discuss with you is what I feel essentially are the social responsibilities of public service. That is, the responsibilities that go beyond just the mechanical task of doing the job. And it seems to me that in looking at that issue, what one is looking at is one's responsibility to others. And if you are looking at your responsibility to others in any capacity, I suggest that rule number one is that you have to be sufficiently humble to recognize that you personally are not the center of the universe, but just the opposite. The other people, the people around you, are really the universe. In other words, you cannot take yourself too seriously, but you need to take your obligations seriously. In 1923, seven of the world's greatest financiers gathered at the Edgewater Beach Hotel in Chicago. I'm told that the Edgewater Beach Hotel in Chicago is one of the key luxury combination hotel vacation spots in the world at that time. And these key financiers gathered there to discuss major economic matters together in 1923. These people were all men. This, of course, was unfortunately before the age when women were very active in business, so of course it was kind of part of the old boy club. All men. One of them was the president of the nation's largest steel company. Another one was the president of the largest public utility in the world. Another one was the president of the New York Stock Exchange. A fourth one was a member of the president of the United States Cabinet. Another one was the largest public trader on Wall Street. Another one was the president of the Bank for International Settlements. The Bank for International Settlements is the forerunner to the present World Bank. And the last one of the seven was the head of the largest economic cartel in the world. And these seven men were all very well-known, highly respected. They all came up to the Edgewater Beach in chauffeur-driven limousines, and there was great publicity about this gathering. It was almost like you read every once in a while, there'll be a group of mafia dons gather somewhere in New York State. But it was this kind of a gathering. I mean, very, very impressive group. And they, of course, were looked up to by people all over our country and the world as outstanding successes. These seven men controlled more wealth through their various businesses and activities than was contained in the entire United States Treasury. And they gathered and they discussed business and economic problems at the Edgewater Beach for 3 days. It is interesting to see what happened to those seven men. After this meeting, they went back to their various endeavors, and within a few years, here is what had happened to those seven men. Charles Schwab was the president of the world's largest steel company. He died penniless and alone. Arthur Cutton was the head of the world's largest public utility. He went abroad, died alone, not only penniless, but very much in debt and without any friends. Richard Whitney was president of the New York Stock Exchange. He served a term in Sing Sing Penitentiary. Albert Fall was a member of the President of the United States Cabinet, and he was released from prison, very ill, so that he could die at home. Jesse Livermore was the biggest trader on Wall Street. Arthur Franzen was the president of the World Bank, and Ivan Kruger, the famous Swedish match king, was the head of the largest cartel in the world. Those three all committed suicide. So here you have these seven great people, and they are truly public servants in the sense that they are leading major business activities or governmental functions, and they are respected, they are tremendously influential. And what happens? They have, two of them die in debt, penniless, alone, without friends. Two of them go to federal penitentiaries for violating criminal laws of the United States. Three of them commit suicide. You can't help but ask yourself, what was missing with those seven men? What caused that end to all of them? Well, we know, of course, what happened economically, that times got bad, and the famous stock market crash of 1929 and so forth. But I suggest to you that a real problem basic to that, as you look at that, is that, frankly, they simply didn't stand for anything. I suggest, and if you study their lives in detail, you will find that they were just consumed with the mechanics of their particular function, of their particular businesses, of their particular governmental activities. Kind of a personal ego trip and consumed with the mechanics rather than any sense in any of them of an obligation to others. Therefore, very much turned in rather than turned out. And I suggest that that's not a strong enough reed to stand on. Times got difficulty. Those were houses built of cards. And therefore, there isn't the internal strength, whether you call it a spiritual strength, whether you call it a moral strength, however you want to define it, it wasn't there to sustain them in difficult times. Recently, to bring this story up to date, recently we have been reading what I suggest are appalling news accounts of leading financial figures in Wall Street that are not only being charged with civil violations, but indeed are literally being arrested for criminal violations of our federal securities laws. 2 weeks ago, three of the most prominent traders on Wall Street, all three associated with major investment firms, were literally arrested in their offices, handcuffed, and taken to federal court for proceeding in connection with violation of insider trading laws. Now, insider trading laws, as we know, are laws that provide that people like corporate directors of public companies, officers of public companies, certain investment bankers that deal with stock offerings and debt securities of public companies, that so-called insiders are restricted in what information they can give out to anyone in connection with the stock of a publicly held company. The reason being, the very obvious reason, is that public stockholders ought to be able to buy and sell stocks and make investments on a fair basis and not on some basis that's unfair because someone on the inside, a corporate director or an investment banker that's working with a company, has tipped somebody off that this company's going to have a big earnings report or a bad one or this or that, so that then that person gets an unfair advantage. It goes to the very heart of the American capitalist system, because our capitalist system is based on the theory that we have in our whole society, and that is that we essentially are all equal before the law, that regardless of race, color, creed, ethnic background, rich person, poor person, regardless of sex, the theory of our American government, and it's a magnificent theory, is that we all should be treated equally, so that when you have rigged security markets, when you have persons on the inside taking advantage of that information improperly to the disadvantage of the average investor, this isn't just some minor matter. This isn't just something, say, oh, well, that doesn't make any difference. Nobody got hurt. somebody did get hurt. The point is that it corrupts the very system, economic system, and system of fairness that our country operates on. And so it's a very serious matter. Now, we're seeing that going on right now. And it's interesting to look at those individuals and read about them and see just who they are, the men, and they've all been men so far that have been arrested in connection with these matters. They're characters. Number one, they are all very well paid. So question number one, if they're so well paid, how much is enough, and at what point does it just seem like perhaps greed? But they're all very well paid without having to trade on the insider information. Secondly, very respectable people. Dark blue suits, eat lunch at the right clubs, have summer homes in Maine. Part of the true financial New York East Coast establishment. In other words, great, great respectability in that sense. And then, of course, third, and I find this very disturbing, but all of these gentlemen that have been charged so far are very well educated. Most of them have graduate degrees beyond a college degree. Many of them have law degrees. As a lawyer, it doesn't please me. Many of them have MBAs. The point is, they are well educated, well paid, part, if you please, of the establishment, and here they are, in effect, engaging in an activity that can only be described as an act of greed. And clearly illegal. I mean, these are intelligent people. There isn't any question but what they would have to be aware that there are some problems in what they're doing. Now, what does all this mean? The 1923 group, and again now we've got the 1986-1987 group. What's the lesson in this? The lesson to me is the point that I made originally, that when you look at public service, and I suggest to you that you are a public servant, whether or not you necessarily are working for government at any set period of time, if you are the president of a large corporation, or you are a major investment banker, you are affecting the lives of people in the public very definitely. The corporate president is obviously affecting the lives of his employees, his stockholders, and their families. He or she is also affecting the lives of people that deal with the products. Is the advertising legitimate and ethical? Is the product a legitimate product in an ethical and moral sense? All of these sort of things that affect the lives of the general public. So when a person is in a pronounced position of responsibility in private enterprise, you still have these public responsibilities, which, of course, those in public life, government employees, and others obviously have. So I'm suggesting that all of these people have these public obligations, and my point is simply this, that if you just start thinking about yourself, your acquisitiveness, and you quit thinking about the obligation to the outside world and to others, well, then you're in trouble, and you have the kind of problems the seven financiers in 1923 developed, and you have the agonizing problems that these people have today that have been charged with these securities violations. And those are problems that go to the very heart of our form of government. You may say, well, but there's always going to be difficulties, and we just should just allow for it and do the best we can. I'm reminded of a few years ago, the Montana State football team had a disastrous two or three seasons, and before the new season started, the Montana State coach, a gentleman I suggest must be a true latter-day Will Rogers, made the statement, and I quote, "This year we definitely will have an improved season. Last year we lost 10 straight games. This year we have only scheduled 9 games." Now, I suggest to you that one way to look at this issue I'm raising about public service would be to back off, schedule fewer games, don't be so concerned about it. In fact, attempt to do less, don't accept the challenge. And that might be easier to do, but I suggest to you that it's really not possible, because whether one be a governmental official, whether one be a teacher, whether one be in private enterprise, the bottom line, obviously, is that the system, this wonderful system we have in our country is not going to work if those that are in positions of leadership are functioning just for themselves, what I would call is the me-first syndrome. It's interesting to look at the lists of bestseller books that show up on the New York Times bestseller book list once a week and on others, or just to go through a bookstore and see what's selling today. There are some fine books that are selling, but there are also some that really cause you problems. One that's been a big seller in the last 2 years is a book that's called Win by Intimidation. Another one that's been a big seller called Watch Out for Number One. One of the best sellers today is a book dealing about one of the investment houses in New York City, about the House of Lehman that recently has come upon bad times. And that is a story about the inner dealings of these large business persons, the directors and owners of the company, and how in efforts to increase their own personal earnings, why they drove their very responsible and well-established business to the wall. It's the old laying the gold, the goose laying the golden egg story, just in a modern context. The point is that I'm coming down so hard on is that simply that if the system's going to work, it's got to be public service oriented. And there's more to it. There's more to the free enterprise system than just my own free enterprise. There's that obligation to the others, and you have to be mindful of it. Now, whether you call it a Christian ethic, which it certainly is, or whether you call it just a personal ethic or the ethic of any other religion, it's an ethic which says that each of us has a responsibility that is stronger to others than to ourselves. It's an outreach obligation. And I suggest that is absolutely essential. Now, it's easy enough to say that in general terms. It's in effect to say, well, we all have this obligation not to be greedy. We have this obligation to others that's stronger than to ourselves. And how do we do it? Well, I'm going to suggest five exact ways to do it that I think are examples. I would say, number one, and again, whether you are the head of a government agency or whether you are in business or whether you are a teacher, or wherever you're doing, whatever your position of public service and leadership is, I suggest, first, when you look at your job, always look at it in terms of the human and moral issues that are out there. In other words, when you look at your position, don't just look at it as, well, what papers do I have to shuffle today, or how many of product X do I have to sell to meet my quota, or if I'm a lawyer in a law firm, how many cases can I try this month, or what do I do in order to get some clients, or what about the billing process? I mean, sure, those are the mechanical things one has to do, and you certainly have to be efficient and technical in your skills, and that's why we all go to school and study. But beyond that, I say look at the moral and human issues out there and address those as best you can in your position. What are these moral and human issues? Well, one of them is, be sure that you have an equal employment opportunity plan. Be sure that if you are hiring people, that you are hiring people without any discrimination, that you are giving complete opportunity to anyone, irrespective of sex, creed, race, ethnic origin, political viewpoint, anything else. It's absolutely essential. Break up the old boy club. When I started to practice law 32 years ago, the legal profession was strictly an old boy club. The number of women in the profession was less than 2%, and racial minorities were less than 1%. Within a generation, I'm pleased to say that the increase in the number of women has been substantial. There are now approximately 20% of the profession is women, and approximately 39% of the law students are women, so that will increase. The percentage of racial minorities in the legal profession has risen to about 8%, but that is backing down now, unfortunately, I think largely because of economic conditions. There aren't near enough racial minorities in the legal profession today. There need to be more. These need to be concerns that lawyers running law offices or anybody running a legal department need to have, so that a lawyer running a law office needs to look at that office and say, okay, do we have a fair employment policy and a fair promotion policy once on the job? Are we treating women and racial minorities as well and as fairly as we are treating the standard white male Caucasian. That's number one. Number two, take a look at the moral issues surrounding whatever your activity is. If it's a business, take a look at those products. Are you manufacturing and selling some product that you have some ethical problems about? If you are in a position in the government office, are you being sure that your people and yourself in dealing with the public and with the people you're responsible to, are you sure that you are creating an atmosphere that is one of openness and fairness in all senses? In other words, this leads me to my second point, is look at the human issues, the moral issues, be sure that you keep those up front. But secondly, be a role model yourself, personally. By that, I don't mean play God, keep humble, but you and your governmental agency or your business or your law firm or whatever it is ought to be a role model that others can look to and say, well, that's something worth imitating, that type of operation. Particularly in public service with governmental officials. I find it very disturbing. And I'm well aware of this because I talk to people around the state a lot and around the country. Public attitude toward government, and for some good reasons at times, is really not very good. A lot of people have a rather dim view of governmental officials. And I suggest that one of these reasons is that government officials and public officials more and more need to remember that they've got to be role models. If you are going to be a public official, or indeed if you are going to be the head of a major business where you are in a position where you will receive some notoriety, you're going to be a football coach, you're going to be the minister of a church, you're going to be someplace where people will be seeing you and looking to you, you have got to set an ethical and moral stand personally that people can respect and look up to. And if you choose not to, if you don't want to, then don't take the position. I think that's an essential thing to remember. In other words, what I'm saying is that the person in leadership, frankly, has got a greater obligation to act morally and ethically and not violate the speeding laws and not gamble and not do a lot of things like that will cause public questioning. The person in the public eye has got to be the role model, the example, and I don't mean to be some sort of a stuffed shirt, holier than God type. Will Rogers once said that just save me from anybody that comes and announces to me that they want to do good. Well, I can understand that, but the point is people will respect government much more and they will respect your business much more if they look at the leaders of government or they look at the leaders of the business and say, these are fine, ethical, moral people. And that's my point. I think it's essential. But it takes some doing. I would say the next thing, in addition to looking at the moral issues, the human issues, the be a role model, is to be very open with the public. I think that's part of the social responsibility. Public, justifiably, is very suspect of secretiveness, particularly in government. And I think we see this all the time now. We've seen it in national government in recent years. We're seeing it currently. The problems in confidence in government where there is what the public perceives to be too much secrecy, where government leaders are not really opening up and being candid and telling the public what's going on. It seems to me that's essential to be very open. And therefore, I think one of the practical, specific things in carrying out this social responsibility is for people in positions of leadership to not only be very open, but to get out amongst the public, is to avoid intellectual or cultural isolation. When I was a practicing lawyer, I was frequently, almost on a daily basis, in the Douglas County Courthouse, trying lawsuits there in offices there, one thing and another. The Douglas County Courthouse is the biggest gossip mill in the state of Nebraska. But it also, notwithstanding that, one being there constantly and being around keeps in touch with what people are thinking. You don't keep in touch if you're holed up in a little office or just one little spot. The only way that you can really know what people are thinking, I suggest, is to get out amongst them and then listen as well as hear. Listen to what's said and try and remember it. And I think that's very important, and to make a point of it. And I think people, in particularly in government, have to make an effort to get out. I think people that work in the state capitol building are well advised to physically leave the state capitol building and go out and eat lunch in other places, and primarily public restaurants rather than private clubs, and eat in the capitol cafeteria where all kinds of people come. Why? Just to get out of your own little narrow bailiwick and observe the public and listen to them and keep in touch. I think that's essential to your responsibility to understand what people are thinking, and therefore you can respond properly. Now, I would also say it's essential that you don't play God. You know, nobody is in possession of the Holy Grail. And I think there's a tendency, particularly in public servants, to sometimes play God, and you just can't let that get to you. You know, Hawthorne, great novelist Hawthorne, once said, "The influential classes, like those who take upon themselves to be leaders of the people, are fully liable to all the passionate error that has ever characterized the maddest mob." And then, you know, in Proverbs, in 10th Proverbs, verse 17, there is this wonderful passage: "Anyone willing to be corrected is on the pathway to life. Anyone refusing has lost his chance." And then finally, lest one think that we're always right that we play God, one of the recent airlines, major airlines, I won't identify it, got a new computer system, which was supposed to be the latest thing, and the computer system belonging to this airline printed 6,000 instead of 10 replenishment notices through an error. And the result of that was that the airline found itself with 5,990 surplus orders of mint chocolates. Now, again, the point is to keep that sense of humility. Don't play God, and be willing to listen to others and take criticism. I would say also, clearly, an ethical obligation of public service is always appeal to people's higher motives rather than their baser motives. And I think this is terribly important. The exploitation of people's fears and of their worst feelings and worst emotions, I think, is absolutely unconscionable. You know, it's a lot. You should always aim your gun high. It's better to shoot the feathers off the bottom of an eagle than to shoot the fur off a skunk on the ground. And what I'm saying is that appeal to people's higher motives, not their lower ones. And I think that's essential because, after all, that shows a respect and a dignity for people. You know, you're showing contempt for your fellow men and women if you are appealing to their baser motives because you're saying that their baser motives are really what control them or what more important. And I don't believe that for a minute, because if I thought that, I wouldn't think there'd be any hope at all for society or anything else if we all dealt on the basis of our baser motives. I think the ethical moral concept is obviously to appeal to our higher motives. And then finally, I would say in closing that the final thing to do is to always be willing to try new ideas, to look ahead out to the future. You know, it's very easy to think that everything we're doing is just right. And I think we need to be skeptical, even of the experts. I mean, let me read a statement. This is Thomas Alva Edison, who certainly was one of the great inventors of all time. But here he is. Let me read a statement that he made that after the first public demonstration of his new invented talking machine. He says, "The talking motion picture will not supplant regular silent motion pictures, because there's been such a great investment in the silent pictures." Now that's Thomas Edison. Here's the leading music critic. Here's the leading German music critic in May 14th, 1737, talking about the music of Johann Sebastian Bach. Bach, I think most musicians would say, you had to pick out one musician that was the greatest of all time, it was probably Bach, and if he wasn't the greatest, he's in the top three or four. Here is what the leading German music critic says about Bach's music during Bach's lifetime: "Mr. Bach's compositions are deprived of beauty, of harmony, and of clarity of melody." So really what I'm saying is that be willing to try new ideas. If we didn't try new ideas, why, nothing would ever progress. In 1899, the president, or the head of the Patent Commission of the United States, one Charles Duell, recommended to President McKinley that the Federal Patent Office be abolished. And there's this remarkable letter that Duell wrote to President McKinley in which he says, "Mr. President, I respectfully request that you abolish the United States Patent Office. You don't need it anymore because everything that can be invented has already been invented." That's in 1899, before airplanes, before automobiles, before computers, and so on. So I think what I'm saying is keep an open mind. In closing, I would simply say that you are in public service in all ways. It isn't just a question of being working, say, for government or working for a nonprofit organization or for education. You are a public servant in whatever you're doing. And as such, your primary responsibilities are to make the system work not just for you, but for everybody. We have a remarkable system of free enterprise in this country, and I hope and pray that we will preserve it indefinitely. But we will preserve it indefinitely only if we do not abuse the system. The system is no different than our bodies. You cannot abuse your body and be healthy, and we cannot abuse the system. We cannot, in effect, be selfish, greedy people and make the system work. And so my message is simply that in order to make the system work, we must look out to others. Governor and also Senator Dwight Griswold, that this lecture series honors, was himself an example of a true public servant. If you study Governor Griswold, Senator Griswold's life, and you talk to people, and there's still people in our fine state that knew Mr. Griswold, and you talk to them, you find that this was a very hardworking, steady, conscientious person that took his obligations very seriously. And I think that it's that example, that's the role model concept. I think it's that example that we try to follow. It's been an honor to be with you. You were fortunate there wasn't a piano here. You would have had to listen to some of that, I'm afraid. But I hope that you'll have me back again. Thank you very much.
Attorney General Speier has agreed to take some of your questions, and we have some time left for that, so if you'll direct those questions at him. Yes?
I heard you speak at the Nebraska Committee for the Humanities Dinner.
Yes.
And I'd like you to tell us what impact the humanities and the fine arts has had on your public life.
You know, I love that question. That would be comparable to asking George Brett if he thought that baseball was a youthful activity. I hesitate to talk about myself because it's a kind of a dull subject to talk about myself but let me say this, that in my own life, I have been very involved in the arts and humanities. I was a music major in college and went to law school and then went to graduate music conservatory. Almost went into music for a career and in fact did spend some time in music before practicing law. My father thought I was a crazy mixed up kid that really couldn't get his act in order, but be that as it may, my own feeling is that the humanities and the arts really the civilizing factor in our society. It seems to me that the music, art, theater, all of these kinds of activities are really what give life a dimension that makes it meaningful. And more than that, and the point I'm trying to make today is let's keep humble. I think an appreciation of music and art, humanities, fine arts, does keep one humble. You know, for example, when Beethoven was my age, he had already composed about 25% of the world's great music and had already been dead for 4 years. And my point being that if you are concerned about the fine arts and the humanities and you have an interest in these and really some sensitivity to them, you will then put yourself, I think, in the right place. place in the planet, because you'll recognize that you will develop a respect for those types of persons who can do that. If you really love music and then you play a Bach chorale on a pipe organ, you think, you know, this is so far beyond anything I personally could think of or compose. I mean, it keeps you humble, and it's just a gift of God for someone to be able to do something like those composers have done. But you get that sense, and I suggest that the humanities, the arts, fine arts, and all are not only the major civilizing factor we have that make life pleasant and entertaining and give it a broad sound dimension, but also, I think, in terms of one's personal temperament and personal outlook on life, that these matters give you a sense of perspective about yourself and about the world around you that I think is very valuable. Other questions? Yes.
Would you give your ideas on teaching values in the public school system in light of the recent decision in Alabama of the abandoning of all textbooks?
Yes.
Could you repeat the question?
Yes. The question is, would I give my views on teaching values in the public schools, with particular reference to the Alabama case this past week, which is a case in Alabama in which a federal judge has ruled that a number of textbooks used in the Alabama public schools are in effect a means of teaching secular humanism, and that the judge has found that secular humanism is itself a form of religion, therefore, as a form of religion, cannot be taught in the public school, so these books cannot be used. That's the Alabama court decision. I would say that's not final. I'm sure that decision will be appealed, and it only affects, at this point, Alabama. Well, first of all, clearly the American system of government is not valueless. It is a system of values. Our Constitution, I think, is the most remarkable public instrument I have ever seen, and our Constitution is a set of values. And particularly if you read the Bill of Rights in our Constitution, it's a set of values. What are those values? Well, those values are some of the things we've been talking about this morning, but that is respect for individual dignity, for the rights of individuals, on the other hand, the obligations that one has that go along with the rights. You have your rights, but you have an obligation to recognize the individual rights of others. And this runs through our Constitution. That's a value system. Now, of course, what the Alabama case has said is that the public schools, by, in effect, refusing to teach specific religions, like, say, the Episcopal religion or the Baptist religion or the Roman Catholic religion or Buddhism or any other religion, by not teaching one of these religions, that's proper because of separation of church and state. But by not doing so, it's become so secular in orientation that secularism in itself is a form of kind of anti-religion, and that also violates the Constitution. That's what that federal judge has said. My own view is that on both of those counts is that obviously values must be taught in schools, public and private. And by values, I mean respect for each other. And I also, in values, I mean the concepts that are carried through our Constitution or other major governmental documents. Also, it seems to me that my own view is that you can teach about religion, and should, without teaching it as a given. In other words, it seems to me if you are going to understand American life and be a knowledgeable person about life in America, you have got to have some knowledge of the influence of organized religion in our history. You've got to know that, or your education isn't complete. And so I suggest that courses can be taught about religion. Not proselytization, not saying you ought to believe this religion, you ought to believe that religion, but to teach what they believe. I believe that can be done without violating any separation of church and state. As far as the Alabama case, I think most constitutional lawyers around the country would disagree with the result of that Alabama case and would predict that case will be overruled by a higher court on appeal. Now, will remain to be seen. but I suggest that that is a very, very likely result in that case. Again, that most constitutional scholars, myself included, not that I'm a great constitutional scholar, but I agree with the constitutional scholars on this point, would say that that case is not sound law, that secular humanism is not in itself a religion, and that the case has the effect of being a censorship of books, and that is not proper. Therefore, I would predict that Alabama case will be overruled by higher courts. Let me mention one last thing on this whole question, is that our Constitution, the tension in the Constitution on these church-state issues is this, that our United States Constitution, so does the Nebraska Constitution, does not require a complete banning of religion from the public arena. The Constitution requires two things. First, that the government cannot sponsor religion, the so-called establishment of religion. Government cannot sponsor or favor a particular religion. That's one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is government must encourage and allow for the free exercise of religion. So government can't sponsor a religion. On the other hand, government must allow one to practice his or her religion. Neutrality is a key word. Government must be neutral with regard to religion. But that neutrality does not mean you ban religion, all religion, from the public arena. What it means is you attempt to be sure that government isn't sponsoring a religion, but at the same time, government must accommodate each of us in our free practice of our religion. And of course, it's difficult to draw the line on those as to when does one's accommodation of religion suddenly become sponsorship. For example, the United States Supreme Court has said that it's going beyond accommodation to allow prayer in public schools, that's actually a sponsorship of religion, therefore you can't have prayers in public schools. That's a recent United States Court decision, and it was a split decision. All judges didn't agree. And those are the kind of issues that you get, and they're very important issues. Yes, sir.
What would you say to someone who said that capitalism, as you were talking about before, is motivated, in effect, by greed, that greed is what makes it work? I hear you saying that within the system, somehow we've got to offset the influence of greed. Some people would argue that's where capitalism derives its motive power.
Question, how do I reconcile the thought that capitalism is essentially, some might say capitalism is essentially based on personal greed with the public good? How does one reconcile that? I had a roommate in law school that made that argument on a daily basis. has sold out to the establishment. He is a very prominent, well-paid corporate lawyer in New York City today. I would respond that way. I think that's a very good question. I think that the whole free enterprise system, of course, is based on the idea that I'll look out for myself and I should have the freedom to take care of myself. But in looking out for myself, that I'll do what's good for myself, and then somehow if each one of us looks out for ourselves and we have the freedom to function that way, then the public good will ultimately be served because there'll be countervailing interests and it'll all balance out. And it will work and we'll live happily. That's basically, in its simplest form, what our capitalist system is. I am not a theologian, but I would be the first to say that certainly there is greed in all of us, and certainly one can make the argument that the system basically is based on a sense of personal greed. But I would say, that you can draw a line. It's hard to do, but I would say that there are different types of greed. There's greed for money or personal acquisitiveness. There's greed for power. There's all kinds of different concepts there. I personally feel that a modified capitalist system, which is really what we have in this country, we don't have any pure capitalist system. We have great regulation of our lives, and I think we need a lot of it. For instance, our free enterprise, I have the right to run my business as I see fit, and yet that right does not allow me to discriminate against you on the basis of race, color, creed, or sex. That's a restriction on my free enterprise. And that's a proper restriction, it seems to me. And there are many others. But I think the way I would answer the question, sir, is to say that I think all life's a series of compromises. I don't think we have, in terms of our economic system, absolutes. And so really what I'm trying to say and what I strongly believe is that I believe that the capitalist system, even though there's plenty of greed in there, I think that the greed can be reined in if people will attempt to. I have that confidence. Some say that that's naive. They say people are too greedy, they won't be good enough to make it work. Well, it's worked for 200 years, and I think it worked for another 200 years. And I think people are basically good, but I think we have to be ever mindful of it. And so my feeling is that although there's the basic greedy concept there, that there are enough of us, there are enough people, I don't know whether I am or not, I try to be, but there are enough people who will modify the greed and serve the public good, and so there will be a compromise. Others would say that's not possible. I think it is. And I think you see some good examples of it. You see good examples in public service of many people that take public service jobs. Well, take school teachers. There's nothing more important than being a good school teacher in terms of making our system work. And I think school teachers are a perfect example of men and women that sacrifice their own personal acquisitiveness in order to serve a public good. That a school teacher is one that says, well, I'm not going to be so greedy. I am going to serve the public good. I'm going to earn less money because I want to help young people learn. I think that's a good example. And I think there are others. So I think it's a compromise, sir. I think it works out, and I've got faith in it.
If we had more time, I'm sure we would have a lot more questions and interesting answers. Thank you, Attorney General. We appreciate it.
Today, University Forum has presented Nebraska State Attorney General Robert Speier, the 1987 Griswold Lecturer in Political Science. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private, undergraduate liberal arts college located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.